Hello, and welcome to Practical Significance, a podcast to inspire listeners with compelling stories from statistics and data science and to propel data-driven careers forward. Here are your hosts, the ASA's Director of Strategic Initiatives, Donna Lalonde, and Executive Director, Ron Wasserstein.
Well, welcome, everyone. This is Donna Lalonde, and I'm the Director of Strategic Initiatives and Outreach at the ASA, and I am super excited to welcome you to the first ever episode of Practical Significance, our new podcast. I'm excited because I get to talk with wonderful colleagues, and I get to have a conversation with Ron Wasserstein, and so I will turn it over to my good friend, Ron, to introduce our guest.
Thank you, Donna. I also am super excited about Practical Significance. I'm executive director of the American Statistical Association, and in that role, I get to meet with and interact with a lot of really interesting and fun people. And there's no one higher on that list than our guest today, which is why we're so delighted to have Rob Santos as our first guest on our initial podcast. Rob is the 2021 ASA president, and he is vice president and chief methodologist at the Urban Institute. And Rob, we know because we know about the rich variety of things that the Urban Institute does, that you are involved in a lot of different projects and have been over the course of your career. And during that time, what are some of the projects that have really stood out to you that are really particularly memorable?
Well, thank you for that softball question, Ron, and welcome everyone. Hello, Donna. It's just a delight to be here. Thank you for the opportunity. So I'm a public policy researcher, a statistician at the Urban Institute, and over the course of a 40-year career that spans beyond the Urban Institute, I've been involved in a number of projects that transcend my involvement and my training in survey research as a sampling statistician and a survey methodologist. And so I'm going to talk about a couple of them that really go a little bit beyond simply drawing samples and getting observations of populations. The first one is the housing discrimination study that I've been co-principal investigator on a couple of these for HUD, the Housing and Urban Development Department. And they periodically, usually about every 10 years or so, they need to do an assessment of the Fair Housing Act and how things are coming along. And so what we do is we attempt a random sample of the housing market, both sales and rental. And we do it to get national estimates. And we typically stick to urban areas. So we draw a national sample of metropolitan areas. And then within them, we've done it two ways now, sort of the old school way and the more modern way. We draw samples of listings of advertisements for rental and sales properties. And then we send two individuals that are trained to go inquire about those housing opportunities. The particular study I'm going to talk about is housing discrimination against people of color. But we've also done these for housing discrimination against the disabled, for transgender populations, and others. Housing vouchers, having a housing voucher. But I'm going to talk about people of color. We send two testers, so to speak, to inquire. First, they call the landlord or the sales representative, and they inquire about the property. They make an appointment, they go visit, and then they review the property that's available, whether it's rental or sales, and then record the things that happened during that instance. They never get to the point of signing a lease or engaging in a sales contract or anything of that sort. And typically the two individuals, one would be a white person and the other would be a person of color. The three types we have done are individuals who are African-American, individuals who are Latinx, and individuals who are Asian. And we do it in enough quantities so that we can build separate estimates of differential treatment between whites and specific people of color, whether they're African Americans, Latinx, or Asians. And we trained them to have and to talk about having equivalent financial resources, assets, things of that sort available to them, so that the only difference would be the racial and ethnic status. And going through, we call these paired tests because we go through and we draw the sample of ads. We send these pairs out. We randomize what order people get tested in, whether it's the white person going out first or the person of color going out first or vice versa. And then they record their experience in terms of really basic stuff. First, whether they can even get an appointment. Secondly, if they get an appointment, whether the landlord or the sales rep even shows up. Next, if they do show up and there is an encounter, so to speak, where they go through and study a property, what was the type of property that was shown? Was it the one that was in the ad or was it something else? Were they steered towards another neighborhood if it was sales? And what were the characteristics of that neighborhood? Or were they shown other properties or rental units? And what were the characteristics of those? What types of questions were asked? Were any enticements provided? Like, if you sign now, we'll give you the first month's rent off. Things of that sort. It's really interesting. We found over the years, since we've done it in two different cycles in the year 2000 and the year 2012, I believe, we found that housing discrimination still exists, but it's in different forms. So because of the Fair Housing Act, landlords, real estate agents are being trained, and so they know what to say. However, you still have instances where, on the whole, people of color are not being shown as many units as folks who are white. Those are the types of more subtle, they could even be unconscious bias that are occurring more contemporaneously. What's interesting is that back in the old days, in terms of survey sampling, like I said, we drew a sample of urban areas or metropolitan areas. And then back in 2000, we purchased every Sunday, or really Saturday, the Sunday papers, because they had the real estate sections, and then had them flown into Washington, D.C. from all over the U.S. And then we would pick them up on a Sunday morning, send somebody out, pick them up, bring them back to the office, pull out all of the real estate sheets, whether rental or sales, and then put little sampling grids that were made out of cardboard sheet with little random squares cut out of them, lay it on top to draw a random probability sample of units, you know, basically a cluster of 2, 3 to 4 units, and then process those, subsample them, take out ineligibles, and then fax them back out to the local housing groups that were doing the paired testing so that by the evening they could send the testers out. Well, by 2010, we got a little bit more sophisticated and we were able to harvest with permission from places like realestate.com, from Zillow, from the standard, you know, standard realty websites, and then draw samples accordingly. This time with the twist that we would draw them in proportion to both the sales or the rental, if we were doing rental, that existed in the current area, be it a local census tract or a block. So it was rather sophisticated. The basic data collection was the same, sending pair testers and looking for differences. But it was really a really fascinating application of policy research where you mix survey sampling and maybe experimental design with the pair testers and then do the equivalence testing to see to check for differential treatment. So that was one. Any questions on that, Ron?
Rob, that's really fascinating. And yeah, about a million questions, but I'm going to boil it down to much fewer than that. Just a two, maybe. Do the housing representatives who are involved in this, I assume they never find out that they were part of a study. Is that correct?
That is correct. And in fact, there were some IRB issues associated with that. This notion that you're burdening landlords and real estate agents with folks who actually have no intention of a real transaction. And is that an appropriate burden without their consent? So it is the case that they never knew. We intentionally would not provide any findings of individual landlords or salespeople back to HUD for investigation, because this was supposed to be a statistical assessment of the conditions to the extent to which people are following the Fair Housing Act. So we weren't in enforcement. This is not an enforcement methodology. And so we simply went about our way doing that. The IRB, the Institutional Review Board, approved of our methodology because in any types of transactions, there are instances where people will just go and view a house, like go to an open house and talk to the realtor, even though they live two houses down. They just wanted to see what was going on in the house. So we felt that that was a good resolution.
Thank you, Robin. One more follow-up, and then I know Donna has her own set of questions too, but were there flagrant instances? Did you ever hear from any of the people out in the field of really particularly egregious examples of discrimination?
Yes. They were most prevalent in our studies of discrimination of housing against transgender individuals, where at presentation, folks would simply, tell them to go away. They were also present in the housing voucher study, discrimination against housing vouchers, where the testers were instructed to reveal that they had a Section 8 certificate that they could use for rent. And landlords would simply say, no, we don't take those, and slam the phone down, even though in that jurisdiction, in that city, there was a law from the city council saying that you could not discriminate against those types of things. So it does happen, but in terms of regular racial ethnic testing, we saw very few instances of flagrant discrimination because of the good training that's been given to realtors, to landlords and such. There's been enough history of the Fair Housing Act that now, unfortunately, things are much more subtle. In fact, we knew of entire communities that were segregated, even though there were homes for sale and rentals for rent, but they knew, those communities knew not to advertise in certain ways, more subtle, unfortunately.
So, Rob, my thought went to COVID-19, I'm sorry to say, but and you were describing a situation where there was a face-to-face interaction. And I wondered if you wanted to take just a little detour to talk about how the work of the Urban Institute has been disrupted by COVID-19 in terms of the kinds of interactions that you have been able to have over the last year?
Yes, thank you for that question. At Urban, we, along with pretty much every other research organization, have come face-to-face with the impact of the pandemic on our everyday research. For all intents and purposes, since March, all human interaction between researchers or research staff and the public have been suspended. And so we've had to move from those in-person interactions to virtual interactions. The process has been a little slow. There have been instances where we simply couldn't do the research. For example, in prisons, typically you go into a prison, and I've done prison studies, you go in and they assemble a group of inmates, well, where you can pass out questionnaires and have them complete them, self-administered, and then you bring them back. That's simply off. That can't be done even virtually, at least, based on the stuff that we're doing. Focus groups and in-depth interviews, telephone interviews, web self-response interviews, for surveys can be done. Some of the more vital in-person interactions for site visits, for program evaluations, are much more difficult, because sometimes you want to observe, say, the program being implemented by going into the room and observing the interaction between the trainers, people providing the service to the trainees, and you can't do that very effectively. So it has had an impact. We and others are learning our workarounds for the time being, and whenever it is appropriate, allowing in-person interaction. I will conclude by saying that I'm an IRB member of the Urban Institute, and the Institutional Review Board has put in place guidelines for human subjects protections that not only encompass the usual, make sure that there's consent and that people understand what's going on, the benefits, the risks, but also we've included explicit instructions and requirements during the time that in-person interactions recommence. And those protocols need to state clearly how the researcher will provide protections to the human subjects that they are personally interacting with against contracting COVID if they happen to be asymptomatic. So that's really important. And I believe most IRBs are catching on that that's an issue that they have to take care of.
Thanks. It's an incredibly interesting and challenging world that we're living in. So I kind of want to switch gears, Rob, but I also don't want to shortchange the second project that you mentioned that you might want to share.
The second one is the World Trade Center collapse, and a project that I had when I was living in Austin with Newstats to identify, to find the survivors of the World Trade Center collapse and interview them on their egress, on how they were able to exit the building. And this was done for NIST, the National Institutes for Standards and Technologies. And they wanted to know how well the protections that are created in buildings, how they performed. So they wanted to know, you know, things like, were the stairs wide enough that to allow both individuals coming down as well as firefighters going up? What happened to folks who were disabled and needed to be literally carried downstairs? Did the sprinklers perform as intended? And things of that sort. And so the measurements were fascinating. We did have to track down individuals who survived the World Trade Center by simply having their name and their city that they lived in at the time of the tragedy. And then we found them, we drew a random sample of them, found them, and then interviewed them. And what we wanted to know was, what did they see, hear, smell at each instance leading up to them making a decision to do something to exit? So it was important because, for example, you'd say, you know, why smell? Well, it turns out that if the sprinklers work properly, then you should have that thunderstorm smell. Like sometimes you can smell the sort of the saturation of the water right before it storms. And that's a certain molecule. It's a heavy water molecule. And if they could smell that during the course of egress, that would tell the firefighters that, yes, in fact, the sprinklers were on. Also, there was the smoke issue and the fire issue. So it was a fascinating, really important study. We took it really seriously. It absolutely broke our hearts, and many of us would come home crying every day after talking to some of the survivors. We even had to interview individuals, family members of non-survivors who were able to speak to us, to somebody on the phone before they passed away, to find out what was going on during that time. So we took this very seriously. We did our work, and to this day, it still has a real emotional impact.
Oh, I can imagine. And as you think, Rob, we're coming up in 9 months, something like that, on the 20th anniversary of that event. It's still very fresh for many people. Thanks for sharing that and for extremely interesting work that you're doing. We wanted to switch up on you a little bit here from your work at Urban to the work that you hope to do during this coming year as president of the ASA. So if you want to chat a little bit about your goals, hopes, and dreams for your presidential year at ASA, that'd be great.
Oh, sure. Thank you for that question. I am delighted to be able to serve the members and the American Statistical Association, the statistical community, through being president. And what I've committed to is something that I think we really need in these dire times of COVID and the impact that it's had on society, not only in the U.S., but worldwide. I think we need to really reach out and build community with each other as statisticians, reach out and help our communities locally and help our communities in society, in larger society, both in our nation and globally, as I mentioned. And the types of initiatives that I would like to do would be those that draw from our association members and our infrastructure, like our sections, our chapters, our committees. All of these individuals have, at some level, volunteered to make for a better association, to make for a better statistical community and a society. And so what I want to do in terms of building community is to reach out and do three things. One is to build and engender our membership to value each other and to value being part of the American Statistical Association. And we do that through helping each other. We have such a wonderfully diverse big tent that includes, you know, data science, it includes theoretical statistics, your mathematical statistics, applied statistics, the pharma industry, biostatisticians, survey researchers, economists, et cetera, et cetera. It's such a great diverse tent that we have room not only to work and help each other within our own specific specialty area, but also reach across and help each other with just basic stuff like how do we do better Zoom calls? How are we more effective in hiring? How can we better network with each other and build our careers in a COVID world where we can't go to conferences and interact in person? How can we help our students, both in school, graduate and undergraduate, but also our international students who are having a really tough time staying in the U.S. with, you know, really weird policies that come and go and challenges of financial duress and things of that sort. You know, some of our students are hungry. They need help. And we need to be able to reach out to them and find ways to channel resources and information so that they can have a better chance of being successful as a student and then welcome them in and mentor them and work with them towards a valuable statistical career. There's also society. We need to help society. But with our statistical acumen, we have a lot of knowledge that society needs right now in terms of trying to deal with understanding the numbers that are coming out of the pandemic, the numbers that are coming out in terms of the vaccine and its efficacy and whether people should take it or not. There's so many ways that we can help, not only in those circles, but in other circles as well. So, you know, we just came off a very contentious election, and folks are wondering about those types of numbers. We should be able to speak to those as well. And of course, there's a topic near and dear to me, which is the decennial census. And there's so much that we can do. It's a cornerstone of democracy, and there are issues that will need to be addressed with that. So building community in terms of its own members, building community in terms of reaching out to our student bodies, and then community in terms of reaching out to society better. I'd like to focus specific sub-initiatives on those areas. And then the next one would be in terms of building even more diverse statistics community through building pipelines with HBCUs and Hispanic colleges and universities as well. And we have things programs like StatFest that are going on that are incredibly popular have proven track records for building and creating interest in statistics with minority students, students of color, and not only building interest, but then resulting in PhDs and masters and people, statisticians of color emerging and becoming part of ASA and then helping each other out. I want to build a pipeline that features a pay it forward component so that we know that we can give to others and have those folks benefit from our assistance to become better statisticians, to get into the statistics world, and then have them understand the value of reaching back and helping the next generation come forward. So those are the types of things I would like to do. I pretty much touched on everything else, so I think I'll stop there and see if you have any questions.
Well, just want to say thanks, Rob, and Donna and I look forward to working with you on those projects in the coming year.
I am super excited to work on all of the projects. I think I'm going to focus on one, and that's the opportunities to contribute in the public policy arena. And I wondered, you know, given based on your experience at Urban and some of your volunteer work, and obviously the your upcoming presidency in the ASA, so what advice would you give to members of the community that would like to make a contribution to public policy? How does somebody get started?
Well, you get started by actually, you know, reaching out to a community in need. So, for example, I've been working with Feeding America for over a decade and a half on their technical advisory group. And I didn't necessarily reach out to them. They reached out to me. But as part of that, I came to know and work with local food banks. So here in Austin, there's the Central Texas Food Bank, and I've reached out to them because of my awareness of the big needs of hunger in Texas and all over the U.S. to see if they could use some expertise in the area of statistical analysis, thinking through the usage of available data and resources to do things like community needs assessments. And so it's just a matter of reaching out. So if I was a statistician and I was a young statistician, I would think about the local food banks. There are places that, say, want to get out and sign people up for votes, and so you need analysis of data for that. There are economic development local groups. Reach out to those. It's basically the nonprofit world that can get you into public policy research and offer your services to them and see if they have a need. Sometimes they have a project that's ripe and they have the data and all they need is somebody just to step in and help them organize the data and frame the research question appropriately, and then you go to town with them. Other avenues include ASA. We have a committee on human rights. You could reach out to that committee. There's the social statistics section. One could reach out to those groups. And then apart from that, if you are a student, there are internships. Pretty much most of the research centers in the country have some form of internship. I know Urban has internships as well in our health policy group, in our justice policy groups, reaching out to those and finding out what the cycle is. Typically, they accept around now, in fact, applications for internships in the summer, and then they make a decision sometime in February. So doing all of that type of outreach, I think, would be really useful to get involved in public policy research. And they can also just contact me and get on LinkedIn, and I'm happy to provide as much assistance as I can.
Yeah, and Rob, of course, they can feel free to contact me as well, and I'll help make connections.
Excellent.
I'm super excited about working with you on this in the upcoming year. But I'm going to conclude with a question about one of your creative outlets, because although I know that you are an excellent photographer, and I know that you have even been an official photographer at South by Southwest, I don't know how you got started with this. So how did it happen?
It's a kind of funny story. It so happened that if you're familiar with the Austin City Limits Festival, which is different than South by Southwest, every fall, there is a 3-day outdoor ginormous music festival that, you know, typically like 75,000 people or so attend. When a COVID world, it's not happening, but it will someday get reinstated. But I had been attending that since its inception back in the early 2000s. And it so happened, I was at one of them on this pleasant day, I think in 2009. And I was listening to music at a stage and I was up at the front. And I noticed that there were a bunch of photographers going into the pit in front of me. It was like this gap between where the audience was and the stage. And they waltzed in and started taking all these pictures, these great pictures of the musicians going at it. And then they waltzed out after three songs. And I said, man, that looks really, really interesting. I'd really like to do that. Well, the problem was I knew nothing about photography. I didn't even own a camera. And so I decided on that day that I was going to try to get myself into a pit to take pictures, live music pictures. And so I went and I got myself a little DSLR and a half decent one. And I started snapping pictures and just trying to figure out on my own what I was doing. And at the same time, I said, well, you know, having a camera is one thing, but getting into the pit at a music festival is quite another. So how do I do that? And I recalled that I had a friend of a friend who was in New York City who had started her own music magazine. And so I went to my friend, who was basically the guy I go fishing with, one of the guys I go fishing with in Rockport, Texas. And he had met this woman from New York who was independently wealthy and started her own music magazine. And I said, hey, can you contact your friend and see if she'll get me media credentials for the Austin City Limits? And I'll give her all the pictures that I take, you know, for free. And he did, and she said, okay. And so the next thing I know, the very next year, I had credentials to go into the Austin City Limits Festival to take pictures. By that time, I had a couple of cameras. I knew absolutely nothing about what I was doing, but I was waltzing in there with all the other photographers who were looking at me really strange because obviously I didn't know what the heck I was doing. But I was taking pictures. Crazy pictures. I took a bunch of pictures, like 3,000 or something, sent them all over to the magazine and never heard back. And then the next year came up and I said, let's do it again. And got my media credentials, went in, took a bunch of pictures, sent them out. Wanted to do it the next year. And Austin City Limits said, no, you need proof that you're actually using the pictures before we'll give you credentials. And that's when the magazine that I'd been working for basically took a look and said, sorry, guy, you have no idea what you're doing. And so they declined to offer credentials for me. And so I was basically kicked out. But by then, I had learned enough going on that I was able to put a pretty decent portfolio together of live music. And it's interesting. You take, 20,000 pictures, and yeah, maybe 50 by chance are going to be really good. And so I submitted that to South by Southwest because I found out that they were looking for photographers, and they accepted. And it was interesting. My first year was 2012. I've been working with South by ever since as their photographer, as one of the, you know, up to 100 photographers. And it's interesting. The first 3 years, it's like a boot camp. You learn everything. Everyone helps you out. It's like a big family. And while it was clear that I was out of my league still, I learned a lot about live music photography to the point that I've been published and such. And I also learned that it's better to be in the front office. So I ended up becoming a photo crew chief. So I got to evaluate the photographer's pictures and select photographers and help train them a little bit. But I just give my hats off to photographers. They're such creative, passionate artists. I could never do what they do. I will only aspire to do it. And that's my story.
Well, that's great. And we really thank you for being our very first guest on our very first podcast. We want to share with our listeners that this information, these stories that Rob has shared, clearly show the practical significance of the work that he does at the Urban Institute and the plans that he has for the American Statistical Association. But it's also worth mentioning that we struggled a little bit to come up with the name for this podcast. We didn't jump right into the name Practical Significance. So I thought I would share with you as we go out, among all of the names that we thought of and didn't use, in the spirit of David Letterman, I thought I'd share with you the top 10 rejected names for this podcast, the least of the least, let's just say. So coming in at number 10, the Well Below Average podcast. Number 9, Absolute Error. The number 8 rejected name for the podcast was Regressing to the Mean, the podcast that puts you back in your place. Number 7, Skewed to the Left. Number 6, Biased Estimators. Number 5, Definitely Unstructured Data, the Dud podcast. Number 4 on our list was Living in the Rejection Region. That didn't make the cut either. Neither did number 3, The False Discovery podcast, or number 2, The Dull Hypothesis. But the number 1 rejected name for this podcast, The Control Group, starring Donna and a placebo. But the Practical Significance was our final cut. Donna, over to you.
Well, I just want to say thanks to Rob and to Ron, and to promise our listeners that if you come back next month, we'll have another great conversation. And yes, another top 10 list as well. So thanks, everyone. We look forward to connecting. Feel free to reach out to us via social media. And Rob, thanks so much for sharing some time with us.
Thank you, and goodbye, everybody.
Thank you for listening to this edition of Practical Significance, the podcast of the American Statistical Association. A new episode will be coming your way next month from AmSTat News, the ASA's monthly membership magazine.